session number 10746, rule 2.
Barton Reel took.
I met Captain Dickens when he was writing his book, when he was on a trip with us to Kiel to visit the German survivors and to discuss it with them. And I don't think he gave us sufficient credit, the gunnery people, in any way for the number of hits. I think we scored far more hits than were announced by the Germans. They tended to play down the amount of damage done. But the fact is, the efforts they made afterwards for the second battle proved that the damage we'd done actually was colossal at the time. And I don't think I'm quite certain in my own mind that had we used direct action impact ammunition, I'm sure the damage would have been much, much greater. Much greater. Certainly, the explosive nature of the shells would have done far more damage than semi-armor piercing, which tended to go right through both sides of the mess deck, with nothing to stop it. We did two attacks, and we hit everything that was everything that remotely resembled a German ship, either destroyer or merchant ship. The amount of return fire was negligible. An odd army gun, there were some bullets flying, but generally speaking, the Germans took off. Most of the troops ashore headed straight up the railway line on their way to Sweden. They didn't want to know. The German sailors did what they could to save their ships. They were in a hell of a state. They told me afterwards that on the Anton Schmidt and the Wilhelmheidkampf, they lost a tremendous number of men. And these men, I give them credit, they'd been on their feet for days on end. They fought the tremendous seas, and German ships were not good sea boats. They were top-heavy. They were not intended for ocean-going as ours were. And they took a fair old battering. And by the time they got up there, they were exhausted. And the captain of the Anton Schmidt told me himself that it was the first time he'd taken his clothes off for the best part of a week. He turned in, he said, and he heard this mighty roar and the torpedo hit. He said, and he ran up the companionway and the sea came in to meet him and washed him down again. He got away with it, Captain Burma. He was a very fine sailor and very good company.
What was his name?
Burma. B-O-E-H-M-E, I think. It was Burma. A circumflex, I think, over the E there. I think it was Burma. His wife, Tilly, became a great friend of ours. The ships regrouped, and our captain decided to make one last attack. This, we felt, was pushing it. We were not too happy about this because by now, of course, everywhere was well aware that there was a naval attack. At first, I think they thought it had been attacked from the air. But now everybody, the whole area was alive, and we knew now that this was going to be troublesome. Anyway, we went in, we did a third attack. Plastered everything, as I said, that looked like a German ship, where they were sinking or floating, or we hit everything we could. And we just couldn't miss at the range. And then came out of the fjord, formed line ahead, and set off down the fjord. Now, as we set off, three of the ships, the ten ships had gone up there. The ships had split into three forces. Five had gone to Narvik. Three had gone further up. They'd gone up to their port side, the left-hand side of the fjord, to Herjung's fjord. And two had turned off. The one, I think, whose washes we passed through, had gone into Ballingen fjord. Now, these ships were much bigger than ours. They carried five 5.9 guns, which are almost a 6-inch. Much bigger, heavier armed, much bigger crews. And as we came down the fjord out of Narvik, the three from Herjansfjord were now fully awake and fully aware that there was a naval battle going on, came hurtling down on our starboard quarter. So we engaged them over the starboard quarter. And as we got down towards Narvik is and Ballingen is about 13, 14 kilometers down the fjord. It's a small little fjord off on its own, little harbor. And these two huge destroyers came out ahead of us. So we effectively were between two fires. They opened fire and hit us immediately, which they couldn't miss at the time. We'd made smoke and we were covering our ships. But the three on our starboard quarter were engaging the ships astern. We caught it immediately. And I can remember when the first salvo landed, it landed on our starboard side then. They were fine on the starboard bow. It landed on the starboard side. And I remember feeling the ship, the whole salvo landed, and the ship moving sideways through the water, just being pushed sideways as the salvo landed. They hit us again several times, blew away the bridge, made an awful mess of it. And slowly but surely, it was evident to me that something drastic had happened, because the ship was losing way and slowly turning to port. Meantime, we were still carrying on firing. We fired as they passed us. We carried on. And one of the ships went aground temporarily on the other side of the fjord, one of the German ships. But we were too busy to bother with them. But eventually, the ship stopped. We carried on firing at the ships coming down. They were still belting down and firing at us. And then we had the order eventually to abandon ship. But before that, we were still carrying on, and one of the funniest happenings during that time was one in which the gunner and I took part. The gun's crew had gone to look for ammunition, and I was firing the gun on my own at the time. And the gunner, director gunner, Mr. McCracken, who was the officer of the quarters, stuck his head up through the hatchway and said, "Can I give a hand?" So I told him, in pure navalese, to go away and get some more ammunition, which he did, much to my surprise, because I wasn't the least polite at the time. And he threw shells up through the hatchway. I had cartridge cases up there, so he and I carried on firing, still on the starboard quarter. And the ammunition then finally ran out. And I fired the last two shells. And they were ordinary practice shells, made of cast iron, filled with sand, but I knew that when they hit and shattered, they would still cause tremendous damage, because I was firing low at the waterline of the ship and the deck level, so that it caused as much damage as possible. Eventually, they fired off the last round, and a torpedo officer came up and said, "Borton, lower the ensign." So I told him, I said, "Well, can we get more ammunition and carry on?" So he said, "No, that's an order, lower the ensign." So I hauled down the ensign. Some of the battle ensigns were down, but I hauled down the ensign, our seagoing ensign, which was the tatty one on the gaff, which was immediately above the gun deck. I hauled it down and left it, tied to the rail and left it there. Then the cry was "abandon ship" all over the ship. You could hear it. And as I walked forward, the first lieutenant came to the back of the port side of the bridge and shouted for volunteers to go up and help down the wounded officers. So I crossed to the starboard side of the ship and carried on up the ladder, which was in a hell of a condition. It had been battered and it was all over the place. It was in a very, 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 very dodgy condition, and got up onto the back of the bridge. The bridge was a shambles. The gunnery officer, I could only identify by the fact that he wore a pair of skiing boots with black clips on the front. felt boots with black clips, so I recognised that that was all that was left of him. The signal officer, Lieutenant Cross, was lying on his back with his eyes open, looking up at the heavens. He was dead in the centre of the bridge. The captain had been pulled to the back port side of the bridge, and he was actually clinging to the side of the bridge and pointing to the ships, pointing to the shore, telling everybody to make for the shore. He eventually laid back down, and then I found the navigator, who was my particular boss on board, because I was one of the four quartermasters and I used to do assist the midshipmen in chart corrections. He was a very fine officer, Lieutenant Commander Gordon Smith. He was standing in a daze. His skull was fractured, I found afterwards. He seemed to be unconscious on his feet. So I wheeled, walked him to the ladder at the back of the bridge, turned him round and put his hands on the ladder, and then climbed down outside him, making his feet move and making his legs move, and we eventually got down to the upper deck. Sat him down there, and someone came along with a cloth or something and tried to wipe some of the blood from his face. And I found in the meantime that they'd brought one of my own particular shipmates out, a very good friend of mine, Able Seaman Wearty, and they'd laid him down. He'd been in the transmitting station, and he was very, very badly wounded from the waist down. The transmitting station table had been blown open, and he was badly carved about. It was obvious that he was in a very, very poor condition. Well, the ship was, as we understood then, on fire below, and it was obvious that there was no way we could hang about too long. And having received the order of abandon ship, of course, there was little else I could do. So I found a wandering stoker with two life belts, and I took one, put it round Andy, slitting him along the steel deck, and then put him over the combing, little wooden combing, slid him through the underneath the guardrail, and dropped him into the sea. I had to jump in afterwards, jumped in alongside him. I waited for him to come up so I could see where he was. I jumped in alongside him and then turned around and towed him. I don't suppose it was all that far, probably a couple hundred yards. I don't know, actually. I don't remember. At that time, it seemed about 10 miles. But we eventually got ashore and dragged him into the shallows. And the mud and the snow and ice... The Germans were still firing at this time. They were still firing at us. They actually fired up at the hill, at the house to where the men were making, actually. But they didn't machine gun us, which was set at the time. They did not shoot at us in the water whatsoever. But they did shoot up inland. Now, whether these were salvos went over, I don't know. But they did aim at the house, or shells landed near the house where the men were making for. This I can swear to. As I'm quite prepared to say that they were either ricochets or shells that went over the target. Could be, I don't know. Anyway, I had to wait for some considerable time for Andy to die. And it was only when he said a few words to me, and I'd said the few prayers that I could remember at the time, which are not a lot. And these particular ones are my own particular memories, and these I will hang on to myself. He died, eventually, so I dragged him a little further up and put some snow over him, buried him in the snow as much as I could to make it look a little bit decent, and wandered up now, staggered up to the house, which I believe it was about 50, 60 yards, if I remember. I've been there since, about 50, 60 yards from the shore. And to the house which belonged to Mrs. Christensen, who was there with her daughter was there, and we just stripped the house of everything that remotely resembled anything to keep warm, because some people had taken their clothes off to swim ashore. I was fortunate. I'd swum ashore still in my boots and gaiters, in which we'd fought the action, because of course we were ready as landing party to go ashore and take on the German army and march through Narvik, so they said. Anyway, they formed us. We looked after the wounded. I found a young Welsh boy, Daly, Jeff Daly, who'd had his arm, he'd been a sight setter on number two gun, and he'd had his right hand blown off. It was in tatters. And I remember making bandages out of a tablecloth and a very, what I consider then, a very neat sling to lash his hand. I stopped any bleeding he had there, but the cold had largely done that. I made up a pad for what left of his fingers and made a huge bandage for his hand and a sling to lash it to his body. And then we were told then, all those who could make their way were to leave the wounded. The doctor was there, Dr. Wayne, who was Lieutenant Wayne, who was doing a great job, although he'd been quite severely wounded himself, his right arm and shoulder, but he still did marvels with one hand. And we were told then to make our way south to Ballingan. Now, we didn't know where or what Ballingan was, but we were told to follow. There was only the one coast road. So we trooped along. I was in a party of about four particular friends. And we set off along the coast road. Conditions were bad. Snow was quite deep. What wasn't deep was wet and icy. And we walked and walked and walked and walked. Anyway, we got a little bit tired along the way, and we saw a Norwegian farmhouse, or a house, some distance away from the side of the field. So we went up there and knocked at the door. And we couldn't understand, because the Norwegians were saying, "Tisk, tisk." And we didn't know what that meant for Norwegians to go away. But it turned out that Tisk was the word for German. They thought we were Germans. They didn't want anything to do with us. And I don't know whether we sang Rule Britannia or what, but we eventually made entry. And they were very kind to us. They made coffee for us. And our clothes had dried on us by now anyway. We were just numb. We didn't feel cold anymore. But I remember I got rid of my gaiters somewhere on the way, and the Norwegian farmer took my shoes off and filled them, my shoes and socks, and they dried my feet, and they filled my shoes with hay, very, very fine, very dry hay, and put the laces on loosely so that they actually gave my feet, I think they saved my feet from frostbite. So we carried on making our way down to this little village of Ballingan, and when we came there, the village children were there to meet us. And we were weary by now. We'd been on our feet for several days. We'd fought in action. We'd had all the shock and all the trauma of abandoned ship, and dragging wounded and dead about. We were tired. And I'll always remember the young Norwegian children catching hold of our hands and taking us up the hill to the school. And the school had, in a very short time, had become HMS Hardy 2, the second naval establishment of the Hardy. So it was all very, very quickly, all very, very quickly organized, and a scratch meal of some sort, some biscuits and odds and ends were found. But anyway, we just collapsed on the deck in the wooden school, and we just stayed there. We just left. Its school, incidentally, was still standing in 1980, it was being preserved. I don't know if it was a monument or what, but it's still, although it was boarded up, we couldn't go inside. We had our photographs taken on the steps of the school, which sheltered all of us. Anyway, we formed into working parties then when we woke in the morning, divisions and different divisions in the ship. Some helped the chefs, some went scrounging for this, that, the other, firewood and all sorts. Typical naval routine. Grab a shovel and take snow away from the steps and that type of thing. We cleared the area. And our wounded now had been brought to a little house or hospital in the village. So we clean up around the hospital and put sentries there everywhere on the jetty and that sort of thing. It was run as a naval establishment in no time at all. And the thing that one thing that amused me was one of our stokers, one of the less enthusiastic type, was given an instruction by a lieutenant, Mr. Falwell, to grab a shovel and get shoveling. And he told him what he could do with a shovel in words of one syllable, all obscene, sailor style, because he was no longer on the ship and he didn't want any orders. Whereupon we persuaded him to drop his shovel, and we took him round the shed, behind the shed there, showed him the error of his ways, delivered him back to Mr. Forwell, wiped the blood off, and said, "He's ready to shovel now, sir." "Aye, aye, carry on." It was the only breakdown in discipline that I saw the whole time I was there, but he soon learned the error of his ways. I did see a photograph of him being spoken to, I think, by a senior officer on Horse Guards Parade, and he had the most beautiful pair of black eyes you've ever seen in your life, which I thought was a bit incongruous because we got left behind and we didn't get back. So that's another part of the story. But it was the only breakdown in discipline I saw, the boy who wouldn't shovel. Anyway, we were there for several days. Now we're there on the Wednesday and we came on the Saturday, and this during this time I formed a friendship with a young Norwegian boy, Magnus Erik Pettersen, who was a student and hoping to gain entry to Oslo University, and who could speak a fair bit of German, which I at that time, having taken it for 4 years in a grammar school, also could. So it was strange because we spoke in German and I translated into English and he translated into Norwegian for his people. So the common tongue was that of the enemy, which is rather incongruous. But I went to his house and visited his friends and his families, but we were under strict orders not to eat their food because they were not wealthy, not well blessed with food, so we virtually starved. It's the only time I've ever trisected an ordinary Crawford's Mary biscuit into three for distribution amongst my two mates and myself. We didn't fight over the crumbs, but it wasn't easy. But food was that tight. We had very little food indeed. Anyway, I was with Eric at his grandmother's house further along the fjord on the Saturday afternoon, late on the Saturday. I'm going a bit ahead of myself now. I should say that during the Saturday, on the Saturday morning, we were out on the fjord walking round, and we heard this tremendous roar, tremendous rumble, and we said right away, we'd heard it before, that's a 15-inch. And we heard this was on the Saturday forenoon, we heard this tremendous explosion. And we got to the end of the fjord, we got to the end of the Narvik fjord, I said, which is only a small indentation, and we saw destroyers, which we recognised as tribal class, and the older F-boats, we knew them by their markings. We saw a stack of destroyers going up with a warspite. We actually saw her fire a salvo as she passed there from the foreign guns, and it was the most tremendous sight I've ever seen in my life. But of course we knew then that the Navy, as we fully expected, would come up and sort us out. There was no problem about it. It was only a question of when and who. But anyway, we waited and we carried on with our work, and then did the usual things around the house. And I was with Erik Pettersen at his grandmother's house late on the Saturday afternoon when I saw a destroyer coming down the fjord. It was flashing H-87, which was Hardy's Pennants. Now, having been a quartermaster on the gangway and being able to read Morse, I hurtled along to the jetty because I was in a different, my angle of sight was slightly different than the people there, and called them as I passed that there was a ship coming, a destroyer coming in. And the destroyer anchored up the fjord and lowered a boat containing a landing party, and the whaler came alongside, and the first man up out of it was a torpedo man who'd served with me and Hardy on the previous commission when I was in the Med before we went home, Able Seaman Fulton, Mickey Fulton. He was quite surprised to see me dressed in Norwegian clobber, or what passed for Norwegian clobber, standing there waiting to receive him. And it was quite a reunion. They landed the platoon to safeguard the wounded, and then they came along the next morning. A couple of destroyers came in and took us off, and we were split up amongst the fleet. Well, I was unlucky. Some of them went aboard the Forrester and other ships who were almost out of fuel and ammunition and just had enough to get home. But I was sent aboard the Havoc, which was one of my own flotilla. I wasn't unhappy about that. Commanded by Commander Courage, Nutty Courage, of brewery fame. A tremendous man, a fine fighter, and quite a character. And we did a 7 days patrol with the fleet. The others went home, and the following Saturday night, we saw them, or we heard, so I beg your pardon, we heard them being received We heard a welcome in Horse Guards Parade when they met Mr. Churchill. All the panic was all that was laid on for them. Well, we were still flogging around the ocean doing a 7 days patrol with the fleet, which weren't amused at all, actually, because these ships were very, very low on provisions, and although we were on board and we got food, it was what they could manage, and that was about all. They were very, very low on grub. We don't forget we'd all been at sea now for several weeks. Eventually, the patrols finished, and they took us to, I think it was Harstad, and we were put on the Franconia. And they landed us aboard the Franconia, and I'll never forget it. They took us into the dining room. Now, we were literally starving. And we must have looked a bunch, because we were dressed in all sorts. And we went straight into the saloon, in amongst all the troops there, and the dish of the night was cod a la Espanol, I'll never forget it, which consisted of steamed cod, slices of tomatoes, and slices of onion. And I'm sure that in that Franconia, which is one of the Cunard's best cruising liners, it was the first time that cod a la Espanol had ever been eaten with fingers and stuffed into sailors' mouths there without waiting for knives, forks, or seats at the table or anything. We just attacked it we weren't polite at all, but we were hungry. That's my only excuse. Anyway, we came back on the Franconia to Greenock. We were landed at Greenock. We met the flag officer of Scotland, and they gave us a marvellous dinner at the station hotel at Glasgow Central Station. And I can discount completely this story that all Scotsmen are mean, because I went up to the post office at the platform there, and I was, of course, we had no money, we had nothing. The clothes we stood up in. And I was a Scotsman, he didn't look particularly wealthy, and I walked up to him and I said, "Excuse me, sir, I was a survivor." And I asked him if he could lend me some money which I could return to him to send a telegram home. He said, "Not to worry," he said, "come on, we'll do it together." So he wrote out the telegram, paid for the telegram, and said, "Best of luck, kid," and he gave me half a crown, and which bought me a pint in the station bar. He gave me a half a crown, paid for the telegram, and actually I still have the telegram after all these years. 40-odd years, coming 50 years next year. So not all Scotsmen are mean. We travelled by train down to Plymouth Barracks. Long, long journey it seemed, stopping just about everywhere. We got back to Plymouth Barracks, and then we went into the sausage machine. We were met at the station with the Commodore and the staff officers, and taken to the gymnasium and given new equipment, our mail, warrants, money, all sorts of things. Big meal in Jago's Mansions, which is the name for the dining hall, and we were actually allowed and given cigarettes and actually told that we could smoke on this occasion only in the dining hall.